Hey guys, Melissa here. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call the Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast. If I had to choose a descriptor for our family, it would be outside the box. Whether it's adopting three unrelated adolescents out of birth order, or trying to run a coffee shop in our quote-unquote spare time right after adopting, we love adventure. We had to give up that coffee shop, and our three oldest kids are launched for now. But with lots of extended family living at home and a full-time wellness business, there still aren't many dull moments. We've met so many amazing people with fascinating stories along our journey. I'd love to introduce them to you. You're listening to episode 13 of the Uncorked Podcast. Today, I catch up with my friend Monica. Besides having our daughters to tie us together, I think we totally hit it off because we're both these tiny women physically, but have enough energy and opinion to make up for it. We chat about our love-hate relationship to systems and how they so often fail our kids and our families. We talk about the hardest thing our marriages have survived and about a tough situation she's walking through with one of her daughters. Also, just a note, we were so caught up in our conversation that we both used Monica's daughter's name, so to protect her privacy, you'll hear a couple places where I cut it off right after the first sound. All right, let's jump into my conversation with Monica. Well, this week, my guest is Monica Reynolds. So, Monica, welcome to the Uncorked Podcast.
I'm so happy to be here, Melissa. We haven't chatted in a while, so this is a great opportunity to catch up.
It is, and we were chatting a little bit beforehand and talking about all the things we could catch up about. So I promise we will do our best to stay within what I consider a typical broadcast, but I have had other people go multiple episodes, so.
Yeah, we have lots of things we could talk about.
We have so many things. So Monica and I met through our daughters. We both have daughters adopted from Ethiopia at older ages, and Monica, I'll let you go back in a second, introduce the rest of your family, but we met through them. You know, when you bring kids over from another country and when they're older, one of the things that's really important is to keep them connected with as many relationships as possible, and as Providence would have it, our daughters all met in Ethiopia and found out that they were being adopted within 2 hours of each other, I would say. And in the grand scheme of things, she could have ended up like in Montana or something. So that's pretty close, all things relative. And so we've been able to hang out and get to know each other in person, in real life, not in Ethiopia. And so that's been just a huge blessing for our family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think like when I look back at how crazy those years were, and we were just, you know, we were walking through the open doors and we're getting through everything that we have to do process-wise. It wasn't until like looking back that we realized really how fortunate we were to have those continued connections from Ethiopia to here, you know, 8,000 miles apart. Our older children were able to maintain connections and conversation with people, with friendships and people who meant a lot to them in their birth country. So that's been a huge for us. One of the things that I think has When you put things into the make or break category, I think those relationships have helped us to continue to make it. I wouldn't say we made it, but we're continuing to make it.
You're on the make it track right now. I love it. And let's be honest, when you meet another family who has adopted children, older children, and let's make that say like older than 10, you make those friends, like those are friendships that are like gold. You don't let those go. And so I would even say, even if our girls hadn't been friends before, we probably would have been like, and now you have to be friends because we found another family that adopted older kids within driving distance. And so congratulations, you're now forever
new
connected.
Friends. Right.
Right. Because exactly. You can't take those things lightly.
No. And our oldest daughter was actually just talking about your daughter last night because just some of the similar, they had some similar struggles. Our oldest daughter was just, you know, really mulling over the path that one of your daughters has taken as she bridges into adulthood. And so we had a nice conversation about that, you know. What we've learned, you know, with having older children, like children who have come home at older ages, and I think this could be applicable to anyone, but that there's not really one path to success or one path to becoming an independent adult. And I think that needing to explore multiple paths is something when you talk about, you know, what do you wish you would have known beforehand? I wish there would have been emphasis placed on that reality, that just because we have good systems, good educational systems here that work for, you know, kids in the normal range, and I mean normal, like statistically, not in any other way, just kids that fall into a normative, into the normal part of the curve developmentally, educationally, and most of our systems are geared towards those children. When you have children that kind of enter that system, you know, post puberty or, you know, older, as older children, the systems may or may not be the best way to get our kids ready for adulthood. And so I think that we share that in common in different ways too.
Amen to that, because for sure, I think that'll probably be the theme of our conversation is mm-hmm. just systems, and I'm probably becoming anti-system. But before we get too much farther, can you just introduce kind of what your family makeup is? Because obviously you have more than just your daughter who's friends with my daughter. So tell me a little bit, or tell our audience a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so our family is, we have 7 people living in our household right now. We have 2 children that entered our family via birth, and they are, how old are they now? 11, just turned 11 and just turned 9. And then we have 3 children that came home via adoption. 2 of them are older. They're 17 years old. They are not biological siblings, but they both just happen to be 17 right now. And then our youngest daughter, who is 8 years old-ish, maybe 9, also joined our family via adoption. So all 3 of our adopted children were born in Ethiopia, in different parts of Ethiopia. And then our biological children were born in separate parts of the United States, 1 in California and 1 in Virginia. So I think every person in our family was born in a completely different, like, geographic locale.
That is amazing and beautiful. And I love the diversity of all of that. So your first adoption was your younger daughter, right? So you did a younger adoption first and then your older kiddos.
No, well, kind of. When we started the whole process out, our biological children at the time were only 4 and, well, actually 1 and 3. As soon as our youngest son turned 1, we started the process to adopt. So that would have been, we had children who were 1 and 3 years old. And so we started out this adoption process thinking that we would just, that we would be open to a child 3 years old or younger, because really just that's what we knew at the time, right? Like, we're like, oh, these are the only ages that we know how to parent. We don't know anything beyond like 3. We haven't seen it. We haven't experienced it. So
were you like us, where you were like, and we have it pretty under control? Like, not only we only know up to 3, but we've got like birth to 3 pretty good. Like, were you feeling pretty good as a parent at then, or is that just us?
I feel, you know, I don't know if I was feeling good. Our boys were kind of, my firstborn is really outside of the box. So I think he actually did a really good job of paving the way for outside of the box living. He was everything that the parenting books, he's the opposite of everything the parenting books tell you parenting will be. Like, you know, your child will, you know, eat this often, and then after they eat, they will take a nap, and all of those things. Well, he never took naps, like, ever. He would maybe close his eyes when I was driving for about 5 minutes. But even as a newborn, he just wasn't really into sleep. He would kind of come in and out, but never took a long nap. His awake time was midnight till 4 every night. And so he was a difficult transition into parenthood. But I do think that we were kind of like, okay, we can do this. You know, we've got this. We've, you know, figured out, you know, healthy meals and, you know, how to use our imaginations to play and not rely on technology and all of those kind of modern parenting things where you feel like, okay, I'm doing something right. We're doing something right. Everyone's growing, developing. We're using words and sentences. And so I felt like we were like at least as prepared as we could be for 0 to 3. We were wrong, of course. We were completely wrong. a child that enters your home with early childhood, you know, traumatic experiences, doesn't matter how colicky your baby was or how much they didn't sleep. None of that prepares you for children, the realities of children who have experienced pretty extreme trauma and abuse, neglect.
Yeah. So what have some of those realities been that have really blindsided you, where you were thinking, you know, I did some training, I read some books, we're thinking we're pretty ready. And then what has that journey been like?
Everything has blindsided us, like everything. You know, I think that maybe that's one of those like gifts in disguise. You know, had we known how difficult this would be, and I don't mean difficult in like a negative way or difficult in a way to kind of, you know, turn anyone off from this, because I still think it's the most beautiful, amazing, theologically sound. It makes the Christian theology to me completely relevant and applicable in what it means to be part of God's family. But honestly, the realities were just everything. I mean, one that I think has not so much to do with our children and everything to do with them is just how hard this would be on our marriage. And it's already hard to stay on the same page, I think, with your spouse in general. But when you have all of these experiences that not many of your neighbors can relate to, or that are difficult, different from like other kids in school, or the behavior looks different, and what's happening inside of your walls is maybe not how your kids are presenting inside of their classrooms, that sort of thing. I think all of that completely has blindsided and continues to blindside us, but I think we've become stronger through it. In that, okay, you know, here's a new different experience. You know, what are all the angles we need to look at it? But I think also, with our children, the biggest thing that I think was, and, you know, for the past several years, you and I have had conversations about this, but just the physiological impacts of trauma on every stage of development, and how it doesn't just kind of go away, but it's really embedded in their person and therefore becomes embedded into your family's DNA, and just how that plays out and what it looks like, whether it's through food insecurity or dysregulating and being offline, or just that tendency to want to quit and run away, to then, or to fear kind of expressing itself as really either disrespectful looks or anger, and then trying to explain to the adults who are in your children's life that my child's not trying to be disrespectful. Her anxiety is like out of control right now. And so the way that she looks might look one way to you, but really it's her kind of wanting to be hidden, or, you know, just not be seen, in her words. I don't want to be seen. So all of that stuff. I don't remember one part of our training or one book that we read early on that really spoke a good word into any of those realities at all. I mean, yeah, we had our outlets covered and we had the right amount of beds in each room and, right. And right. We knew it would, quote unquote, this is going to be difficult, but my gosh, like none of that really hit on the reality of what difficult means, and lonely and isolating and all of those things. I think that it's a journey I wouldn't trade anything for. And most of that, I think, is rooted in our Christian faith and who I see God being, and what it means for us to be God's children and God's family. But those books, man, I think we like put them into the fire pit a couple of years ago. I'm like, this is worthless. This did not help us. This was not, this is not, this little paragraph here did not really tell us anything worthwhile about what a rage looks like. And then what do you do with other kids in the house? And, you know, so. I don't know. Yeah. What about you? What were you most unprepared for?
Yeah, all those things. There just aren't enough words in the world to describe all the feels and to immerse yourself. And it is so difficult. And in that same vein, when I think about, when I talk about our experience, you know, I try to frame it in a redemptive light, because as you said, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I have learned so much about God's character and how much Jesus loves us. And like, really, I think this tiny sliver of a glimpse of really what unconditional love really is. You know, you like say it, I grew up in a faith tradition and you know, you hear unconditional love and you think, I know what that means, like love no matter what. And it seems so simple. And then when you're really put to the test and you really have to love no matter what, and not just, I don't know, I just, the impact of that was so blindsiding to our family, to me personally, for sure. And I would say early on, even just, we had a situation, our first adoption was Ty from Korea. He's our youngest, and I'm an adoptee from Korea. And so I just naively thought, we've got this all wrapped up. Like, I've been there, I've done that. And so we'll just proceed as normal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our training for that adoption really had a lot more to do with institutional behaviors, which mm-hmm. I know some of your struggles probably have stemmed from that. But Ty was never in an institution. And our kids from Ethiopia did spend some of their time in an institution, but Ty hadn't. He was in a foster family, and a foster family that we knew had cared very well for him. Mm-hmm. And the rest of our training was about, like, the race, like the interracial part, you know, like how sure. to be aware that your child would be the only, you know, like they would look around and not see people that looked like them. But in our case, that's not true because I mm-hmm. look like him, and I have a brother and sister who adopted from Korea. And when we did our little, like, did you ever do that bead experiment where you have to, like, put colored beads in a cup for, like, that represent, like, the people in your family and your boss and, like, your pastor? And anyway, they had all these little, like,
pony
beads.
No, I've never done that. What do you put beads in a cup?
Yeah, yeah. So everyone gets a cup, and there's, like, all these beads on the table. So there's, like, white beads for, like, the Caucasians and red beads for, like, Indians. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, all the colors that we talk about that are, like, now considered racist. So there's, like, black beads and uh-huh. yellow beads and red beads and white beads.
Oh,
and,
awesome.
And you have to, and they go through this exercise, and they're like, okay, grab a bead for your husband, grab a bead, or your spouse, grab a bead for each of your children, grab a bead for your parents, and grab a bead for your boss and your neighbors and all these things. And so, of course, most people look down and see a cup full of white, and then, like, and then you grab a bead for your adopted child.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we're in a room, and everyone's beads are white. Like, all their cups are full of white mm-hmm. beads, and then, like, there's a, like, one lone yellow bead or whatever a country you're adopting from.
Uh-huh.
And in our cups, it was, like, the opposite. Like, my sister was married to a black guy at the time, and both of my siblings are Korean, and our kids are, you know, half Korean. And so mm-hmm. we had these, like, really colorful cups, and I was like, psh, like, he'll be fine. Like, he's going to look at his mom, and I look just like him anyway. So
yep.
I, like, totally blew off most of our adoption training. Like, it wasn't a big deal. So, and because of that, I think even the mentality, like, I didn't even come into it thinking this will be hard. So we were blindsided in every single way possible, pretty much, is how that worked out.
Yeah, exactly. Because who could possibly, you know, how could a child possibly be more unique, you know, right, than their physical appearance? So we...
Yeah. And I just had never even heard of, like, kids from hard places or, like, what it meant to lose a primary caregiver and how some kids process that, because I clearly hadn't processed that in a way that had, you know, impacted me in a way that, you know, was really visible. And, you know, now I look back and now I can psychoanalyze myself and think, yeah, I probably had some things going on. I do have some things going on, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it just wasn't what we experienced. And then
we all have some things going
we
on.
We all have things going on. But then fast forward to our second adoptions are for mm-hmm. our older kids, and we went in thinking that we had our eyes wide open. We had been trained at that point. We were trainers with Empowered to Connect, and we just thought we had a lot more of a fighting chance. And of course, we were blindsided, not in every mm-hmm. way possible in that situation, but in a lot of, in plenty of ways, more than enough ways that, you know. So I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was the impact on your marriage, which is a huge topic. Mm. And, you know, I don't even know what the worldwide statistics are or even national statistics, but I know just from our context and the adoptive families that we know and families mm-hmm. that are involved in foster care, the marriage statistics and the stories, like just what we know, like maybe the 15, you know, couples mm-hmm. we know in our area, it's not pretty at all. It's so sad. And what has helped you guys? Why are you stronger on this end? Because I feel like it either does. Mm. It either makes you or breaks you. Like, I feel like if we get out of parenting these kids still married, then we will be married until we die. Like, there will be nothing else that will shake us to our core. But so it either makes you or it destroys your marriage.
Yeah, it's funny. I everything about life, I think, all of our perspectives, our goals, our hopes kind of shift a little bit when, you know, you go down this road, because everything has to look differently. But it's funny, that's one of the things I say, like, now, like, I just hope that we live, like, I hope this doesn't kill us. Like, I hope that we live to see all of our kids transition into adulthood. And I say that jokingly, but also kind of seriously, like, I hope that the stress doesn't lead to some, you know, debilitating illness, because it can be really, really heavy at times, because I think that, you know, while we've gained a lot more understanding about the effects of trauma. I think what I was going to say earlier is my mom was raised in an institution. And so I thought that I maybe understood things because she spent her whole childhood in an orphanage. And so she would tell me stories. And it wasn't till raising our own children that I was able to kind of look back and things started to make more sense to me with like hypervigilance and this hyperactivity almost. You know, my mom was very hypervigilant, but I just kind of linked that to, oh, she's hyper. She has a lot of energy. But really, you know, in hindsight, it's like, no, that was an effect of institutionalization. Like you can never let your guard down. You can never relax. You have to always be, you know, looking around. Your head is always kind of on a swivel. But I think, you know, in terms of marriage and, you know, thinking, oh, we know what we're getting into, which we didn't know anything. It always tends to hit our marriage the hardest because Fred and I we have to be on the same page if we're going to make anything work. And it's so hard to even get on the same page when you're dealing with so many experiences that are completely outside of what you would expect to happen. Like you can't just assume that you know how your child is going to act in any situation. And you can't, if the only thing that is consistent is inconsistency. Like, right. I think that over time, I mean, we met with a counselor regularly, I think for like 2 years. And it was really the only positive time in our marriage each week. And it wasn't even positive. You know, it wasn't like positive and like, we're really getting along here. But it was positive and it was the only positive connecting time that we were meeting each week. And then we would go out to lunch afterwards. And I think for about 2 years time period, I just wasn't sure. Like I wasn't sure we were going to make it because I couldn't see, there was nothing, like you would look around and you see people maybe celebrating or being happy about things or just enjoying, just simply enjoying a night out. And we're like, we can't go out because I don't know how my kids are going to behave. And I know that other people, unless they've been either foster parents or other adoptive parents, are not going to understand all of these moving parts. And also there's a lot of them. It's not just one or two kids. There's five of them. And the older kids can help, but then they also need to feel safe too. So the adult in the house would have to be nice and calm and all of these things. I think it just became very exhausting in our marriage. And if you're tired and everything is stressful all of the time and you're not taking time to, you can't get enough sleep and you can't rest and you can't nurture yourself, yet alone like your spouse, things just start to fray. And so we just met with a counselor just to honestly keep us our head above water. If that was the only thing that could keep us hopeful that things could get better, then we were going to do that. And then I think just the commitment to it, like there were times where I just wanted to quit. And Fred was like, no, like not quit our family, you know, just kind of quit on the marriage. And yeah. He was like, nah, that's not how this works. And I'm like, no, but I said, we're quitting. And he's like, no, like, but I said, I'm done. He's like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. And I'm like, wait, like, this is like not how this is supposed to work out. You're supposed to say, oh, this is really bad, but yeah, okay. We'll just, you know, figure out how to be good parents. And he's like, no, like, and he just wouldn't budge on that. And so I think his resolve kind of helped me to be more firm. And so I'll tie that back now to my mom being raised in an institution and not knowing things until hindsight. So I think one of the marks on my genes, because my mom was institutionalized, is that I'm also very hypervigilant. And my fight, flight, or freeze is heightened most of the time. And I never attributed that to my mom's experiences and the fact that she was institutionalized. And now we know that those genes are passed on. And so when things in our marriage got hard, my flight was in overdrive. Like, I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to leave. And I don't even know why I would say that, because really my sister would always say, Monica, where are you going to go? You have five kids. Like, you're not coming here.
Right. I'm like, oh. Well, I find it interesting that she assumes that you were going to flee with your kids, because when I was at that point in our story, I was out without the kids.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm out. Yeah. You, like, because I felt like the kids were the stressors. Like, at the end of the day, I was like, if we were married without kids, we would still be rocking this thing.
You were gonna
but so I was like,
You were going to take a bucket and leave?
No, well, we thought about that too. That's also an option. But every time I would fantasize about leaving, it was definitely by myself for sure. So okay. I would have been an easy taken because it would have just been me, and all I would have needed is a quiet corner to rock in.
Nice, exactly. No, I was going to take my kids because I was at that time just thinking my marriage was the problem, like the communication, the lack of communication. Because I think during those years, it was just when I was starting to unpack all of the effects of trauma and how that is impacting all of us, and then the spiritual component of that. And I really believe that evil is always trying to tear down relationships and tear down whatever God is trying to build up. And just really kind of taking time to dissect that. I thought it was my marriage, I'll link that back to my mom's, story too, and that it was her father who was incredibly abusive. And it was, it was that whole story of the mom couldn't protect them and then the kids had to get out. And then just kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say, I think my house growing up was, my parents were firm in that they were going to stay married, but their marriage sucked. And so they lived in separate parts of the house. And I always thought, why are they trying to stay together if they're not really together?
Right.
And so and in my mind, I'm like, I would just leave if my marriage was bad. And so it was that. It was all of those links where I'm like, I'm just going to take my kids and I'm going to figure out something. And then my sister said we couldn't go there. So I had no plan B. Like, where do you go with five kids? And I mean, I never really thought that out like that. But I remember sitting downstairs in my pantry one day, kind of you were talking about sitting in the corner rocking. I was like in my pantry in the basement and I was talking to my sister. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I can't do this anymore. And it was kind of like serious, but joking, and she's like, well, really, what are you going to do? What can you do? She's like, figure it out, And it was the first time ever I had to confront, there's another option to fight, flight, or freeze. Like you can actually begin to work through all the layers, which is daunting, right? It's just easier to leave or just continue to fight. But to even think that there was an option to start peeling back the layers and that there could be healing and that we can work through a lot of these things was a huge realization, because I didn't really think back until that point to relationally, I would just, in the past, before I was married, if things got hard, I would just leave. All right, I'm done. Goodbye. Move on. So yeah, marriage has been hard, but it's been, when we decided that we're going to commit to making this work, I mean, that was a game changer. I wouldn't say we're happy all of the time by any means, but the foundation is stronger now than it was even before the foundation now is stronger than ever, ever in our marriage, before adopting, before having kids, because at least we know we're kind of in this race together.
Yeah, you're stuck, which is a bad word, horrible word.
I was going to say that.
You're committed. Committed is a better word. Committed for better, for worse. And I think that's so interesting how something that other people are listening and probably thinking so obvious, well, duh, Monica, it was going to take work, or how... Yeah. You're a believer. You're not just a believer.
Right.
You're in ministry. How could you think that God couldn't bring that hope and bring that healing back, and that we couldn't work towards something? But I think that just speaks to what happens when you're in that fight, flight, or freeze. When you're hypervigilant. When you're in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking part of our brain is just really not working for us. And kudos to you guys for sticking it out. Kudos to Fred for not just being well, shoot, if you want out, go. Because I know that in our deepest, darkest places of our crisis years, when one of us would show the tiniest bit of I'm out, then we were both out. It was we could both fight if we knew we were in the fight together. But as soon as one of us was done, then we were both done. You know, that was the permission the other one needed to be great, you're done, I'm done. And I can say that we had those conversations, where we'd be I'd be I don't know if I could do this. And he's well, if you can't do this, I can't do this. We're either in this together or we're out of this together. And so, yeah, I just am so in awe of that just strength of character, because we've been there. So I know what that feels like. And so I know that that's not any small feat at all. That's a big deal. I can just read between those lines.
Yeah,
and
likewise.
No, that's a big deal.
It is. And it's not just normal things, right? You didn't know. I think everyone goes into marriage knowing that it will be hard and that there's compromise and you have to communicate and you have to get on the same page and you have to spend time with each other and nurture each other and all those things. This stuff takes it, I think, it takes it to a new level of hard, because It's almost like everything, there are literal things literally, there are things happening in your house every day that are tearing apart the fabric of relationships, because relationships had been so hurt in the past in some of our children. It's like this whole other level. And I don't know. I don't know if it's any different than someone who is struggling with any other, you know, heavy, weighty realities in life, be it addiction or, you know, who knows, you know, what else. I don't know. I'm not trying to compare this to, you know, other real struggles, but it just took it to a place where I'm like, I honestly didn't know. I can't see a way forward at that time, but yeah. Yeah. You know, do you remember that like Amharic phrase book that I think we got before we, I don't know if we got it or we could buy it or something. And there was like simple phrases in there that would help, you know, us connect to our children.
We had a ring of flashcards. I don't know that we ever had a book, but I have this like ring of flashcards. In fact, I've been meaning to like get on our Facebook group and like offer it to someone who could use it, because clearly I'm not using it anymore, but yeah. So, but I get, we were trying to connect like in our kids' languages in ways that they would understand, for sure.
Yeah. So there was one phrase in there, and this is where I did see God, you know, at work. And it was a phrase, and I don't have my book in front of me, but it was just, I will not leave you. You know, I will not leave you. I will not leave you. I will not leave you. And it was, I would say that to our youngest child every night, because she was actually the one who came home the most traumatized and the most visibly distraught. And I would just say that over and over again. And it's, you know, obviously scripture too. I will not leave you. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to leave you. And I said that to her every single night over and over for about a year. And it was one of those things that as I'm saying it to her, you know, it's like a prayer, and it's like I'm hearing God say it. And then also it's reminding me that this is my commitment to my child. You know, I will not leave you. And it's God's commitment to us. And it was just one of the ways that, you know, at the time I thought I was just doing it because I'm like, here's a nice phrase and I need to remind my child that I'm not going to go anywhere because this child has suffered, you know, several losses, loss upon loss. And if I just say this all of the time, but in reality, it became like this circular prayer almost where, you know, I was saying it to my daughter, I was praying it, and I heard God saying it, and it was like this whole like connecting experience. And so, you know, it's not like a pretty like bow wrapped gift, but it was like that assurance that we're not alone. And also, I'm not going to leave. Like, I will not leave. You know, as hard as this gets, I'm not going to leave. And it was very therapeutic just to say that out loud over and over.
Yeah, what a beautiful like little, I mean, sometimes it's just those little tiny threads to hang on to that get us through when we think we're not going to. And how fascinating too, and not fascinating because this is really, it's just a misnomer in adoption that, you know, younger kids come home with less problems and older kids come home with more problems. And so not that I love the hard that your family has gone through, but I love that your family is an example to say that's not always the case, that there's just there are no guarantees in this journey. And I think that's the other reason why families are blindsided, because we go in thinking, well, maybe if we just do it this way, we'll protect ourselves from a little bit of that. And so, you know, it's fascinating. You brought home teenagers, and in a lot of ways, they've been easier than, you know, the toddler that you've brought home. So that's fascinating. But that brings me to, things were going, for all intents and purposes, as smooth as they're going to go when raising teenagers, especially teenagers adopted from other countries as teenagers, which is just, you know, you can't even really wrap your mind around that. Even though we've done it and we've watched our kids live through it, it's, if you think about it, it's just really extraordinary. But you guys have been walking through something this fall with one of your older kiddos that I don't know that it's blindsided you, but I know that when I'm following you, in my head, I know that these things happen, but when they happen close to home, they happen with people that you know in real life and are close to and love, they kind of shake you to your core.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. We have kids in three different schools. So I think that we have different experiences, you know, based on who the children are individually and, you know, just their personalities, their makeup, their strengths, their gifts. And then we had an experience just, you know, it was a carryover from last year. And it did completely blindside me. We live in an area that is globally diverse. We live in an area where our schools are 50% or more, you know, children of color. And so the demographics and the population around here, I mean, it couldn't be more beautiful and just a wonderful, to me, representation of like God's kingdom. And there's so much that we can all learn from each other, like right here in my little community, which isn't really little. We're outside of Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, but it's an amazing community where we can really bridge divides because people are so have such different lived experiences. So I would have never expected within the systems there to be such discrepancy. And there was an incident that happened at one of my children's schools or high school, where I was completely blindsided because our daughter was assaulted. And instead of the school actually like listening to what she said, they assumed they knew what happened simply because all of the kids involved in this incident knew each other. And no adult saw what happened, no principal saw what happened. But instead of listening to what my daughter said, which was someone grabbed me from behind, they came to drew conclusions like, oh, we know what happened. All of these kids are together, you know, and they labeled, the kids were labeled. They were prejudged. They were essentially like profiled, and the administration didn't do really the hard work of getting into the weeds and figuring out who each of these children were individually and what had happened. They just essentially assumed, oh, they knew what happened. And, I was so blindsided by that experience, especially after telling the school, I'm like, our daughter, like if someone came up and grabbed her from behind, I know now that she's dysregulated. And they just were just very dismissive, which then of course made me very frustrated because I'm trying to explain to them how this could have played out. You know, we had her therapist write up a report of like, this is how this could play out. And this was a trauma therapist, someone that's been working since the late 1970s with survivors of domestic abuse and assault and everything. And the school just completely was like, yeah, no, whatever. And they're not hearing it. And not only did they not hear it, they didn't investigate. And it was just devastating. So devastating. So what blindsided me the most is as I kind of went through and started researching was that the disparity in discipline that is administered in our local public school system. And it's, you know, children of color are, for instance, twice as likely to receive an out-of-school suspension than their white or Asian student counterparts when discretion is allowed in discipline, you know, so that's kind of like, you know, not a drug offense or something, but they're twice as likely to receive an out-of-school suspension. And then in school, black students make up like 6.8% of the population, but have received, I think, 24% of like the out-of-school suspensions. And so, you know, the little piece of advice piece of information that I'm trying to track down now is out of that 24%, how many of those was discretion used? Because to me, in this incident, and that happened with, essentially, they blamed her. They blamed her for how she responded to being assaulted, number one. And then they just didn't bother to do the hard work of like looking into, you know, the weeds. And so, yeah, completely blindsided and hurt and still kind of processing through, you know, what is the most effective way to move these concerns through.
Yeah, especially, you know, like you said, in a system that knows it's using disparity and historically, like not just in the last 3 months, but, you know, years and years and hasn't really...
23 years worth of research.
I just, when I read that, I was just blindsided, since we're on that word. I mean... Mm-hmm. I mean, it just is really concerning. And again, in an area where you think this wouldn't be, I mean, I guess we falsely assume that these racism issues have more solid holding, you know, in places in the South or places mm-hmm. that aren't as diverse. But like you said, you are in a very globally diverse area and ironically have like the largest Ethiopian population outside of Ethiopia, like practically mm-hmm. in your backyard.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, what has that been like for Sydney in terms of just processing? Because I'm like devastated for her, not just because of the racial disparity, but because, you know, we work so hard to help these kids learn that they can trust people because relationships are their thing. And then she goes into the situation and she's turning to a system and adults that, you know, we're trying to instill to trust and to obey and to respect and all of these things. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like another relationship slash on the totem pole, which is devastating for kids who already have a history of relationship trauma.
Yeah. No, you're hitting on everything. Like, I've had a couple of weeks now to process this, but it's just that horrible feeling. And you're trying to then communicate this to the adults. I'm like, we teach our children to be honest, to tell the truth, to tell what happened, all of those things. And so essentially what I saw them teaching my children was, is that she's telling them the truth, but then the administrators won't do the same thing. Like, they're not offering my child the same honesty and integrity that she's offering them. And so essentially they're teaching her not to trust them. And I'm like, this is horrible. Like, if they only knew how much effort and energy and prayer and faith and sweat that we have to kind of pour into our kids to help them learn to trust again, and not only to trust again, but to learn that they are worthy and that they are beautiful and that they're made in the image of God and that they are unique and unique in that God has made them only one of them. And then for essentially the adults in their life to, through their actions, say otherwise, you know, to say you're not worthy. And, you know, in this instance is, she has some, learning delays and some processing disabilities. And so, you know, the classes that she's in high school and even the hallway that her class is in, there are, you know, students with learning disabilities and emotional disabilities, and they're all kind of in the same, you know, they all kind of navigate the hallways together. And so in this situation, I feel like the administration just lumped everyone together and was like, bad kids. And that is what it felt like. Because if they were really being objective, they would have listened to what was being said. And so I think it's been pretty horrible. It's been really horrible because she doesn't trust now. And then she still has to kind of, you know, be respectful and to be kind, because those things are universal. You have to be those things. But also she has to be guarded. Like, how does she know who to trust at this point in time? Because twice when she has been honest and kind of said, this is what happened, it was turned on her, and she wound up getting hurt by that. So I think it's been hard. I think it's been really our biggest struggle, and you probably can relate to this, is just simply, I want her to get through this program successfully and to not quit on herself. Because, you know, children who have experienced already so much hardship and hurt are so much more likely to just quit. And so to know that the adults in her, some of the adults, not all, not her teachers, but some of the adults don't understand that reality and are instead feeding in to the statistic, like they're feeding into the pipeline. Like, we're just going to keep knocking you down until you give up.
Or until you do something that society will say, like, well, that was inappropriate. How come, you know, how come our youth are doing these things? And there's so much more to the story in so many of the cases, obviously not in all of them. But, and I think it's important to note here, too, a lot of kids from trauma struggle with reality and the truth. And you know what that looks like, because I know that you've dealt with that in your home. And you know that that's not one of Citizen's downfalls, and that you can trust, you know, that her story is unwavering and real and reliable. And even if it wasn't, she still deserves to be heard out in any case. But
no, and that's her, like, her, you know, that's her downfall is not that. I mean, she'll tell you the truth even when it's just like, you know, even when it essentially says, you know, I did this wrong thing. Like, she's not going to, that isn't her downfall. Her downfall is really just, it's not even a downfall. She goes inward. Shame is such a huge, there's been so much shame in her life that, you know, and shame, I think I've been listening and reading a lot of Brené Brown, but like, she distinguishes shame from like embarrassment or humiliation, in that like embarrassment is, I'm embarrassed that that happened, you know, but it will, this has happened to everyone. Everyone's like fallen on their face when they were playing soccer. Or, you know, humiliation, like someone gets called out in class and then, excuse me, by the teacher, and that was really humiliating. But shame is like, you go right to the person. Like, I'm not a good person. I'm a failure. Like, my life doesn't matter. And her life has been filled with her inner dialogue is a shame dialogue. And so that has been our biggest mountain to overcome, is to negate that and to put a positive word in its place And so for me, it was just when the adults who are supposed to be helping to build her up are contributing to a shame narrative, now I'm angry. And now, like, now we're in a different place. Like, I trust the adults in my children's life. I extend them trust, and I know that we're part of a village, and I can't, I'm not in school. I'm not a homeschooler. And so I love our village of teachers and social workers and counselors. And we couldn't do this without them. And so when, like, the people at the top of that chain are not taking the time to understand how their actions are antithetical to their purpose as educators, it just becomes a different, for me, it was, okay, this is a different conversation. So yeah, it's been blindsided by some adults being unwilling to see how they're contributing to hurt rather than healing.
Yeah. What's the big lesson as a parent that, or even as an individual, that you're taking away from all of this and just understanding, you know, what our culture is like, what the systems are like? How does that impact how you move forward?
Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about this whole idea of, like, broken systems. The thing about systems, I love systems. I was actually just thinking about, like, church systems before we got on this call this morning and how to kind of make some of them, you know, more efficient. So I think that we don't operate without systems. We can't. We're always in the process of trying to organize and create systems. But I think that when you get into the public life, those systems are, they seem to be driven by, you know, fear of litigation, they're driven by the wrong motivation. They're like, instead of being driven by, like, you know, empowering and healing and I don't know, even health, they're driven by fear. And to me, that is what I'm learning. I'm like, that is completely, again, antithetical to the gospel. Like, we're not supposed to be driven by fear, but many of the systems that we're part of are. And so to me, maybe that's where the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this world are colliding. And so I don't know exactly what to do with that. I don't think we can remove ourselves from systems. What does it mean to manifest, to allow the kingdom of God to manifest in those kingdoms, in those systems? That's what I'm really chewing on right now. And as even as I deal with this situation with our daughter, you know, the angry approach was going to take me into the systems of the world. And it was this, I need to kind of draw back from that and figure out how to navigate those systems that are already in place, but to do so with, you know, a kingdom of God mentality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, you know, just this crisis mode with our kids and just the really hardness, you know, we've talked about this before about, you know, the post-traumatic stress of it all. Like, our kids come to us with traumas that are really obvious traumas a lot of the times. And it's no surprise that they have issues like PTSD. But one of the things that did blindside us was I was not prepared to walk out of my parenting journey with PTSD because of my kids. And one of those things, one of the hallmarks of PTSD, at least in my life, is I'm just a mean person now. Like, I'm not patient. I'm not compassionate. I have to work really hard to bring Jesus in and to, like, love other people and to do that thing where you aren't drawn in to the systems of fear and anger and worldly justice. Like, I find myself in situations and I just, like, need to get vengeance. I need justice. I need it in a very worldly sense. And so that's been challenging too, because, you know, I look at myself in hindsight and I'll be like, who are you? You're like such an awful person now. But yeah, like, I am, you know, even just reading as I was watching your story kind of unfold a little bit on social media, you know, I was feeling the injustice of it all and, like, my blood pressure is, like, rising. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I want to be in the principal's office being like, you know, what the heck, you know? And, you know, those aren't the most productive and most the ways that we show Jesus shining through our lives, for sure. But, yeah, so I would totally appreciate that. Like, don't get drawn into the world systems to fix it, because the fix isn't there all the time. I mean, it's really never there.
No, and, you know, this whole, like, everyone now having post-traumatic stress of some sort, that's a whole other area that I think we were all completely blindsided by. Because it not only affects the adults, right? It affects all of the other children in the household. All of the other children, like, you can't walk into someone else's trauma day in and day out or have that trauma walk into you and to not be impacted by that. So that is definitely, and for me, I think that came to a head a couple of years ago. And then I took a year sabbatical. And to me, that was a very healing year for me. And it was that year, God did a lot of things in that year, but one of the things was for me to know my triggers, right? And so I know when I'm beginning to feel out of balance, and that is kind of when I have to start saying no to things so that I can stay more balanced, because I have to. Because I know that when my kids come home from school, you know, anything could be possible. Anything could be possible even before they come home. I could get another phone call from the school and they could tell me something that I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams before, you know, receiving that phone call. So I think, you know, I wish I would have known better, I guess, maybe to prepare myself beforehand. But I think taking that year, and I think you've had years like this too, where you've done different things, or, you know, you had your coffee shop, which I thought was pretty amazing, but then you realized, hey, that's not happening right now.
That's crazy.
This is crazy.
What were you thinking?
Did Melissa just buy a coffee shop? She did. Oh, they did. Okay.
True story.
Right. True story. It was an awesome coffee shop. I liked that. And I think, to me, like, that's the thing. Like, I want to do all of these things, but it's really like, what am I really capable of doing right now in this season of life? And then just being really real about that. Like, right now I feel my ministry becoming like heavy again. And to me, that's a reality check of like, what am I capable of doing right now? Knowing that another ministry in your life is your family. And that, you know, that one is really important because you can't do anything else, you know, unless the family stuff is in line. So, but yeah, it does stink. I think, I don't know. I try to like, it's hard, you know, it's hard. I can tell when I'm getting out of balance. I'm not sure that Fred can tell when he is. And that's a tricky conversation. Like, I can tell right now he's not getting enough sleep because he's grouchy, but it's like, how do you communicate that without it becoming an argument, right? Like you're really grouchy right now. Can you please just go take a nap? And then that will just like, you know, backfire. But
yeah, it didn't work on me when I was a kid. I heard that line a lot from my parents.
Yeah.
You're grouchy. I think it's time for a nap. Of course, now I'm thinking,
please,
someone send me to a nap.
Exactly.
Pronto. I'm on
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Have you ever felt this tired in your life before? Like, do you feel tired a lot?
Yeah, and it's been different types of tired. I didn't realize how many types of tired there were until this season. And we're on an upswing. So I wouldn't say that we're in crisis right now. We're definitely dealing with a lot of different things. We're in a, I call it the season of therapy. So we're in not like counseling trauma therapy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a little bit of that, but ties issues have never been as emotional and trauma based as our older kids, but his come out a lot more in just kind of day-to-day thinking and operational things. So we're doing therapies that are helping to address that. But it looks like 6 therapy appointments a week. So it's like that season where, like, you know, if we decide we're going to jump in and do all the things that we think we can do to set him up for a season of growth, then, you know, you have to cut out a lot of other things because you can't do a lot of things and still make 6 therapy appointments a week. Like, you can barely, you know, like, shower. So, but I would say,
yeah, that's crazy. I can't even get my mind around that.
I know. I can't either. And it's about to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were in the midst of our worst crisis, I was the kind of mentally and emotionally tired that I couldn't even verbalize. And we were still active, like, and I think by necessity, because we really adopted as a family, like, we're going to keep our bodies moving or we really probably will all die. Like, and so we just pushed through and we did a lot of Taekwondo as a family, and we, you know, kept people going to a lot of athletic, you know, extracurriculars, and I worked out like it was my job. And I don't know how I did in hindsight, because again, there were a lot of things going on. The coffee shop was in that season, and we weren't getting a lot of sleep. But we were, I think, that like physical release we just had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But emotionally, I just, my brain hurt, my head hurt, my heart hurt. It was hard. And so the flip side of that has been, once we kind of situated our lives in a way that we could get that breather, I just falsely assumed like we would jump back, you know, like, once we were out of crisis, then we could like revert back to who we were pre-crisis.
Uh-huh.
And that hasn't been the case. And so that, again, because I think I'm just going to continue to be blindsided for the rest of my life. You know, I'm sitting in this season of life thinking we were supposed to be back, quote unquote, whatever that means. And we're still the sense of emotionally and relationally tired, where you know, when we think about, you know, reconnecting with a faith community or, you know, just making friends in our neighborhood or just making friends at all. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It just seems so heavy. It seems so weighty. Mm-hmm. And I'm an extrovert. So in theory, I love people, but that just, it's hard. It's hard to like keep up, and it's hard to have space for other people's, like even just friends that we have from forever. If they walk through a season that's tough and like they might need a meal or like someone to watch their kids, like I just feel like I don't have anything left to give anymore. So that's been hard because we've always been very service-minded and very like action-minded people. And so it's hard to like look at a situation and go like my pre-crisis self would have been all over that. But my post-crisis self might just mail out a gift card.
Right. Yeah. And I think that there's only so many things that can happen in a 24-hour period. But I think like there's only so much that our bodies and minds can process. And I think they start to want to protect us after a while. Like you can't do all of those things. Like it just doesn't work. Yeah. I feel like you though. I feel like we're in an upswing in that I don't feel like, I mean, there was a couple years that felt really dark and heavy and awful. We're not in those years anymore. One of our children, a couple of years ago decided that we were going to do a one word a year in our family. And I think that the first year, like, cause there was so much there was just chaos. And he decided, I think he was like 6 or 7 at the time. It couldn't have been older than that, that our word for the entire year was going to be peace. And so that's what we were working on. Anything that would bring us peace, you know, we needed to be peaceful. We needed to not argue. And so for the entire year, we were working on peace, and he was like monitoring us, like giving us percentages. You know, our family's at 40% peace. And it wasn't until, you know, we thought we got to like 100%, which of course we're never going to get to. But we were apparently good enough in his like 7-year-old mind. And he said, okay, we're done with peace. We're going to move on to joy. And just like simplifying, by simplifying and then focusing on less things, I think like it's been able to happen. We've been able to kind of achieve more peace and even experience more joy. But that does mean saying no to a lot of things, which doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to like not be able to do all of the things all of the time. I feel like people on the outside, I feel like don't like that very much, but I don't know what to do about that. I mean, another choice is to not be healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a really hard time saying, I'm a yes person. So I had a really hard time saying no when it first started happening, but I don't know, it must be like a muscle. So I guess I started to say it a little bit more and more, and there are some things that are still really hard, but I find it's getting easier, and it's really changed my perspective. I think I needed the crisis to really help bring some things into perspective. And so in a lot of ways, like I needed to be at rock bottom before I could do one of two things or both things, which was accept help from our village and just start saying no and stop caring so much about things. And one of the things that I think is a result of my story is I am a control freak. I love control. I love predictability. And you have to give it up when you're in crisis. There's just not enough energy. Like you said, like our minds and our bodies can only handle so much. And so there was so much that needed to be processed, and I needed the space to do it, that I had to give up that control piece in ways and places that I felt God, you know, hammering into my head, like, stop caring about that thing.
Sure. Are you familiar with Richard Foster?
No. Tell me more.
He's like a theologian, but he has, all of his books are on like spiritual disciplines, simplicity. He has a whole book on, simplicity, but, Fred's Bible, his men's group right now is kind of doing the spiritual disciplines. But these books are from like the 70s or 80s or something. They're not new books, but they've been, I've revisited because his group was doing it. I pulled one back out and was just reading it. And it was just comforting to me that like, that saying no is actually like saying yes in a lot of ways, like saying yes to life and saying yes to the relationships that we need to be kind of working on. And it's just been, it's also reminded me of like the importance of, you know, quiet time and just being still and things that wouldn't come natural for me. But I think maybe we could be at a place even larger, like culturally, where I think people are desiring less. I don't know. Like, I feel like everything is too much, and it could just be our lives, right? Not everything we've been through, but like, do you feel like everything around right now is just too much, like too much media, too much consumption, too many choices? Like, I just feel overwhelmed by almost in every area or category that it's just too, there's just too much. And I want to say no to it all, but I can't, like, you know, I'm not going to become a monk and run away.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think about that sometimes. I'm like, mm-hmm. maybe I should just become a hermit. Yes, I agree. And I would say that it is a larger cultural leaning. I think culturally a pendulum swings, and I think it's swinging mm-hmm. in the direction of, I mean, if you just get on Pinterest, like there are boards, full boards of people who are, you know, trying to simplify in the tiny mm-hmm. house movement and all of these things. And so I think it does speak to a cultural movement of, you know, moving towards the simple. And you're finding, sure. I think, millennials and younger generations just pushing back against that. You know, the whole capsule wardrobe thing mm-hmm. is, you know, a picture of that as well. So,
mm-hmm.
so anyway, for sure, we're moving towards simplicity. So I love that idea of simplicity. And I frequently walk through my house and think, I just want a Goodwill truck to back into my driveway and take it all away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think even more so because of our crisis, it leaves us with less margin for all the stuff, for managing mm-hmm. the busy and the material things. I think I'm realizing how much the stuff physically around me even taxes my emotions, even like
totally.
Subconsciously. So
exactly. And that there's so much truth to that. We only use like 20% of our things, right? That's what I just preached on that on Sunday, but not on that, but on First Timothy. But we use 20% of the things in our house. Like that's it. But we have to spend like all of our resource, our mental and physical and emotional resources kind of like thinking about or organizing or worrying about or just even moving from place to place, like 100% of our things. Like if they're there, we have to do something with them. So it's definitely stressful. I want the same thing. I'm like, Jeff, if you just took it all out and we had like a sofa in this room, I think we would just be okay. Maybe a candle. I don't know that we need the majority of things in any room in our home. And we don't have a lot of extra stuff. But
yeah, for sure. Well, so Monica, I am so thankful that you've come. I feel like we could talk for hours. We didn't even talk about microchurch, house church, your ministry, all of those things. But you'll have to come back another time and have that conversation with mm-hmm. me because it's a great story. And your story of your calling to ministry, also a great story. But in the meantime, where can people find you on your blog? And
sure.
you have a podcast possibly coming out soon, which I'm super excited about because that's my new obsession.
Yeah. Well, I have a blog. I have my website is emergingmama.com. I will say I don't write very often right now, but that's mainly because am I writing about adoption or trauma or am I writing about ministry? And those are two kind of different communities. So I'm trying to figure out how to blend that. But I will post on there about adoption and family stuff and trauma. And so, yeah, that's emergingmama.com. But our Collared Chicks, the Collared Chicks podcast, just released its first episode today. And so it released on Fireside, and it should be on iTunes within a day or two. And then you can find us there on our Facebook page, The Collared Chicks, and then also on Instagram. So we're excited about that. That is just going to be a space for women and ministry, so women leaders, women pastors, women, whether, you know, clergy or laity or just women who are leading in some way, just to be able to kind of share our experiences and connect with others in that area. So I'm excited about that.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks so much for being on, and it was really fun to catch up with you. I know you're a busy mama and have a lot of things going on, so I appreciate the time.
Yeah, no, thanks so much. It was great being on, and we'll have to link up soon. Thanks
Perfect.
For having me.
Awesome. I'll have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Guys, I just love Monica, and I hope you did too. If you relate to being blindsided by your adoption or know a family who adopted or is in the process of adopting older kids, consider buying them the book, Wisdom from Adoptive Families, Joys and Challenges in Older Child Adoption. It was compiled by my friend, Dr. Chris, who was on episodes 4 and 5. It captures the wisdom and advice of families who have been there, done that. Okay, so don't you just love the idea of having a theme word for your family? I'm not really a huge fan of New Year's resolutions, but this is such a great, simple, unifying exercise that seems perfect for introducing with the coming new year. What would your word for your family be? I think I would choose community. Our crisis season was very isolating, and we've really been too PTSD to really recover from the authentic community we long for. But we're making some changes right now to intentionally rebuild that part of our lives, and I think a theme word would help me stay the course even when it feels too hard. I'd love to hear yours. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at MACorkum or Facebook, facebook.com/MACorkum. Use the hashtag #TheUncorkedPodcast when you share. Also, if you've been enjoying the stories here, please share with a friend. It might be the best Christmas present they ever get. Speaking of which, if you're procrastinating like me, check out the blog for a last-minute gift guide. It's filled with gifts that give back to the community in a socially responsible way. I'll be back next week with one more episode for 2017. I think my BFF Trisha is coming back, so stay tuned.